The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Welcome to Spirits Podcast, a boozy dive into mythology, legends, and folklore. Every week, we pour a drink and learn about a new story from around the world. I'm Amanda.
And I'm Julia.
And this is episode 153, Multimedia Mythmaking, with Carmen Maria Machado.
You've really been killing it with the guests lately. I'm very, very impressed.
Thank you. I am also impressed with myself that I did not fall all over myself when Carmen came to visit us in the studio. I have loved her writing for a long time. And this is one of my favorite interviews I think we've ever done about like modern myths about TV and film and Gordon Ramsay and also like sexual assault and surviving abuse. We definitely get into some heavier topics. So check out those content warnings in the description that Julia puts together for each episode, just so you can be informed and, you know, make a good choice for you. But I was absolutely floored and I love it. And I hope that you love it too.
Do you know who else makes really good choices, Amanda?
Is it our new patrons, Ray, Rhea, 50 Bad Songs, Christine, Janine, and Wild Geese?
Yes. Yes, it is. As well as our supporting producer level patrons, Philip, Alpha Dogs, Deborah, Molly, Megan, Skyla, Samantha, Sammy, Josie, Neil, Jessica, and Phil Fresh.
They are absolutely wonderful, and they socialize all the time watching their favorite food TV with our legend-level patrons. Morgan, Emily, James, BM Yep, Scotty, Audra, Chris, Mark, Cody, Mr. Folk, Sarah, and Jack Marie.
Yeah, they're all lovely people.
They really are.
What cool folks. I would watch Chopped with them every day of the week.
I wonder if wild geese are more or less chaotic than one untitled goose.
I think because wild and more, less planning.
Yes, but Julia, you notice a herd or a flock of wild geese coming at you. You don't notice the one untitled goose. Just a cheeky little goose who loves drama.
They could pull a whole, like, velociraptors in Jurassic Park thing, though, where they hunt as a pack and one distracts you and then the rest come in.
Very true. I guess I would rather fight one big
horse-sized goose.
Yeah. Speaking of which, as I contemplate just my mortality vis-a-vis geese, remind us what we were drinking this episode.
So you and I were sipping Aperol Spritzers during the episode, but since we mentioned the infamous Gordon Ramsay during the interview, I wanted to recommend for the people at home to make one of his more famous cocktails, which is the Street Spritz. I love the Street Spritz. It's basically elderflower cordial, grapefruit bitters, and vermouth. So like boozy, but also floral and a little bit bitter. I like it.
That's very up Julia's alley. I am doing my best to expand my palate. I prefer the, you know, like extremely whiskey forward, old fashioned type of drink. But I do like a springy drink, especially as we're kind of descending into winter here.
Yeah. So if you're one of our patrons who receives the recipe cards, I'll have a version of this week's for you to try at home. It's going to be really good.
Delicious. And what do you recommend that we like read, watch, or listen to as we're sipping our spritz?
Ooh, so I picked up a book called Sisters of the Vast Black by Lena Rather, which I saw a recommendation on Twitter by one of my favorite authors, Sarah Gailey. And basically the book deals with religion, faith, imperialism, and also humanity. And I'm here for it. It's basically Earth before we used it up and it got destroyed, sent out religious flocks into space. And this follows a sisterhood of religion as they're kind of drawn to people that cry out for help.
Love that. Oh my goodness.
Yeah. No,
your
it's really,
really so
cool.
Good, Julia.
Thank you. I'm really excited for it. And it's one of those books too. I think it's like 150 pages or something like that, where I can read it in one day and I feel really satisfied.
So good. So good. Also very exciting, Julia, is our new merch. We have a brand new piece of merch to share with all of you. We have a spirits beanie. It's getting chilly. You might have to cover up your tattoos, and your winter coat might not have as many of your cute queer pins as your, like, fall jacket, but you can still telegraph to the world that you love all things creepy, cool, boozy, and ghostly with your spirits beanie.
Yes, no, it's really, really cool. I'm a big fan of the beanie in fall and winter, especially because now, like, I have long hair again, so I can, like, show it off with the beanie, whereas when I had short hair, I felt a little bit weirder wearing the beanie. I don't know, but I love a beanie now.
At spiritpodcast.com/merch, you can get the new beanie. You can get the last of our water spirit pins. There are just a few left, and we have those there. We also have now a couple of things from Multitude, and we're going to be adding more. So you can get our exclusive tour posters from Portland earlier this year, and then from our summer and fall tour. They're beautiful. They have little like Easter eggs for each of the Multitude shows. Potterless has new merch. Horse has a shirt that says Sup Nerds, It's Basketball. Join the Party has character pins. Join the Party has pins of Chad and Oatcake and Inara and Tracy, and it is extremely exciting.
I'm so excited for those. I want an Oatcake pin real bad.
So you can see the merch from all of our shows, including the New Spirits beanie, at multitude.productions/merch.
Woo!
Well, with that, I will leave you to enjoy Spirits Podcast Episode 153, Multimedia Mythmaking with Carmen Maria Machado. We are so stoked to be joined today by Carmen Maria Machado, who is going to fangirl a little bit, one of my favorite authors, and someone who is extremely good on Twitter as well, which I think is two different kinds of writing, both of which you excel at.
Oh, thank you. That's a really huge compliment. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. And your books include Her Body and Other Parties and In the Dream House, which is your newest book. And we are just going to talk to you about like anything sort of storytelling, mythology, fairy tale, folklore related. Mm-hmm. And we're so stoked to have you.
Oh, thank you. I'm really excited to be here. Yeah. Where to begin?
Where to begin? Actually, I would love to know, what fairy tale stories were you obsessed with as a kid?
Well, there were a couple. So like anyone who's read my first book knows that I was really obsessed with like the Green Ribbon story. So like Alvin Schwartz and Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark and his sort of whole oeuvre. And so those weren't so much like fairy tales, but more like urban legends. And there also was another series that I was reading up about Alvin Schwartz recently, and I found reference to this other series from that era called, like, it was like Scary Stories to Tell at Sleepovers. And I had this like weird, like tingly, like flashback to, like, I think I've read one of those books, and I really, really, they seemed really interesting to me. So yeah, so I was really into like horror and like retellings. I had this book called The Dark 30 that I had gotten at like a Scholastic book fair, and it was like stories for children. It was like from the South. And it was just like these really like great, creepy sort of Southern stories about ghosts and people with the sight. And I really liked that.
R.I.P. the Scholastic Book Fair.
Bookstores aren't
Does it
the
not
same.
Exist anymore?
I mean, for us as adults.
Oh, yes. Yeah. For us. I mean, yeah. Like, I honestly wish that, like, I could just, like, go. Like, they'd be like, hey, Carmen, guess what? It's the Scholastic Book Fair this month. You can
drop
everything and go. No, I agree. That was, like, my favorite part of the year. And I remember those little, like, sheets that you would be
so
given.
Yeah.
Right? And then I would always, like, circle them. Yes. But I'd circle, like, everything. And my mother would be like,
no,
you get one book.
$10.
You know? Yeah, exactly. Like, and I was like, but I want all of these. And she was like, no.
It's like, you may buy two books. Go
exactly.
Ahead.
I mean, if I was lucky, I had a lot of books. I was a book fiend as a kid. But yeah, so it was like all those like sort of horror books and things like that. And then I also really liked, I actually had like a version, a Hans Christian Andersen anthology that someone gave me, which, like, in retrospect was incredibly inappropriate because those series are, like, real fucked up.
That's that, like, real, really that's, like, dark. Uncut stuff.
Very, very dark. Yeah. And so I remember reading, being like, oh, The Little Mermaid. And I read it and I was like, oh, no.
Oh, no, she died at the end. Oh, no.
Because the original Little Mermaid is, like, horrifying. Like, it's like her tongue gets cut out. It's like she's being stabbed. And she dies in the end. Like, it's just, there's no, it's such a fucked up story. And I was like, oh, okay, well. Like, yeah, but I was just really drawn. I don't know. I was like really interested in that as well. I mean, it's one of those things where like I was a very like scaredy cat kid, and I was like, but I would walk toward what scared me, and then I'd like run away really fast, but then I'd like go back to it. Like that's just sort of, I feel like that's kind of my personality.
That's such
like
a
in
mood.
General.
I understand.
Adult, it really is, right? Yeah. Like so I wasn't like brave, but I did want to scare myself, and even after like. I would read scary books and then I couldn't sleep, or like I would get really upset. My mom would be like, no more. Like, you can't read any more of those. Then I would still do it. I would still come back to them, which I think just, yeah, it's just is me in a kind of in a nutshell.
Yeah, I feel like that makes a lot of sense if you maybe grew up to be an adult with anxiety where you're like, I want to know everything about the thing that terrifies me.
Yeah.
It's going to terrify me more, but then I'll know.
I mean, I was an adult. I'm a hypochondriac, so I feel like that's like a very appropriate, like, you know? But I'm also like, I'm a hypochondriac who like watches a lot of medical shows and like reads articles about.
I feel like that goes hand in hand. Like that makes total sense.
Totally, yeah. Totally. And my wife is always like, are you sure? You want to watch that?
Like, good for you.
She's like, checks it. And I'm like, yeah, I think so. I think it'll be okay. I don't know.
How do you describe yourself and your writing now? I was reading a couple of articles, like interviews and stuff in preparation for the interview. And I heard for the first time the word fabulist, which I believe you used as like a writer of fables, which I never heard before, and is like a fabulous noun that I want to tattoo on myself. So do you see yourself writing like stories, urban legends, folklore, fables? What kind of word appeals to you there?
Yeah, I mean, I think fabulist is certainly an appropriate word to describe what I do. I think that there are like lots of ways to describe what I do. I feel like the kind of work that I'm doing, I'm just really interested in sort of taking what I want from the genres that I want. And one of those genres includes stories that come from kind of an oral tradition of a kind, whether it's fairy tales, folk tales, myths, urban legends, children's hand games, things like that. Those are really interesting to me. And yeah, and I think that's like, yeah. And so I mean, I don't know if that necessarily like tracks directly with fabulism, you know, but I think that fabulism, I don't know, it just feels, that feels right to me. And it feels, and it's, I mean, it's weird because I feel like there are some writers for whom like the sort of direct interaction with those sorts of stories are like their project, like as their career. And I don't think that's necessarily like encompassing all the work that I do, but it certainly is something that I return to over and over and I'm very interested in. And I teach, and it's one of my favorite weeks is to teach the fairy tale and folktale class, because then we get to like talk about adaptation and read, like, I always assign like 50 varieties of Bluebeard, which is like one of my favorites.
Yeah.
And all these like modern retellings and sci-fi retellings, and, you know, The Bloody Chamber, obviously, by Angela Carter, and like just all these really good ways of, so it's like, here's one story and here's like 1,000 ways to tell the same story. And I think that there's something really like beautiful about that. And I feel like, you know, so much of writing is like, when one first starts writing, you're always like imitating the people that you read. So like when I was really little, I would write, and people listening can't hear, but I'm making quotation marks on my fingers. I would write poems, which were basically just me rewriting Shel Silverstein poems. Like I would just take, because I thought they were so funny and I wanted to write my own. So I would like write, like, I don't know, there was that one like Cynthia Sylvia Stout, like wouldn't take the garbage out. Do you remember that one?
Yeah.
And like, the garbage like reaches up to the sky and then like, it's like awful, right? And I mean, what happens is awful. The poem is amazing. And so I like wrote my own version with like a different name, you know, where I was like just imitating, right? And so I think that the cool thing about, and I think that some people don't get that about writing. They think that there's sort of this wholesale act of creation, but like all writing is about what you've read and what you've consumed, like as a reader, as an artist, as a consumer of art. And then you're sort of churning that up inside of you, and like there's something that comes out, and it's like kind of the result of all that. And that's why when I'm feeling stuck with my work, like reading is really helpful to me, because it kind of just shakes all that stuff loose in my head. And I think when people don't read, it's harder to create, to write, because you're not getting that kind of like stuff inside. It's not kind of being put inside of you. So in the same way, but I feel like the nice thing about the sort of folktale fairy tale thing is that it's that idea, but like in this concrete way. So like, I mean, it's true of all fiction, but like the cool thing about folktales is like, you're just like, oh, that's like a retelling of, like, that's a story that has been told like all over the world in some variation, you know, and there's all kinds of versions of it. And like, you can look at different writers doing different things with it. And it's just that sort of idea of the consumption and creation of art, but made in this very like literal and I think even more acceptable and understandable way. So I've just always found it really fascinating because of that.
I love urban legends for that reason. And the scary stories to tell in the dark is also such like a foundational text for me. I would like check it out of the library again and again.
Yeah.
Probably not good for me in retrospect. but I love that.
Or the best for you.
I mean, now I talk about scary stories.
I was
going to
say, I was like, it also like made you literally the person sitting across from me right now. So,
yeah,
you know,
no, it's true. It's true. And I don't know. I feel like there is something about kind of looking at the darkness and like asking it to show you something that it just makes you feel a little bit more on top of kind of the like anxieties and surprises that life can bring you.
Totally. And I think that urban legends, particularly urban legends, like really have a way of reflecting back our fears on us, not just us individually, but like as a society. And like the way that urban legends shift and change reflects like what people are afraid of at any moment.
Right. Because human beings have been looking into the dark and wondering what's out there since we, you know, existed.
Right. Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. Besides the Green Ribbon, which I am such a fan of.
It's such a good one.
What other urban legends kind of stick out in your memory as something that is particularly I don't know, exciting or memorable, or like says something about the folks who tell it?
Oh, I mean, the one that I think of, and it's horrible to like repeat it out loud because it's so stressful. But there was this one that I remember learning when I was a kid. And when you think about the historical context, it actually makes a ton of sense, which is the urban legend about going to like a movie theater and sitting in the seat and you get pricked. And then you stand up and there's a sign and it says like, now you have AIDS. Do you remember? Did you ever hear this when you were like a kid? You heard, okay, usually, yeah.
I remember someone telling me that. I also heard it in gas stations. They would do that where you grab the thing at the gas station. It would be a
there's like, oh yes, yeah. There are a lot of variations on it. It's always like something that you would unthinkingly do in public, like sit down in a movie theater seat or grab a, the gas
like
pump.
A payphone or something.
Exactly, yeah. So it was like the sort of way of thinking about like fear of public spaces, fear of contamination, obviously fear of HIV AIDS, which like, I mean, when I was a kid in the 90s and like that was clearly a thing. And I think that legend's been around or some variation of it for like a while.
Yeah.
And so, right. So it's like, obviously it's awful. And like the way that it, you know, sort of presents, I mean, obviously, it's like problematic in all the ways that are sort of obvious, but I remember it really frightening me, and it made me think about, it's sort of, I feel like, almost like our generation's like razor blade in the apple. You know, it's like not a thing that actually has ever happened, but, you know, it's that it was just such a horrifying idea, and this sort of violation of like, you're feeling, you know, you feel safe when you're just like out in the movie theater or you're like doing whatever, and then all of a sudden, you know, something has happened to you and you've been like contaminated in this way and in a way that's like permanent and unchangeable, because we obviously like, that's the fear of HIV, right? Is that it's not curable, and that, you know, I mean, at the time, like obviously it was like a death sentence that's not anymore, but like, so that one like really chilled me, and like I remember someone that sang it to me and I've never forgotten it. And it's like weird because it's like, obviously it's like so stupid, it's so ridiculous, you know, but it just, whenever I think about, or I mean, that's one that like, that like just comes sort of unbidden to me, like I think about it sometimes and I'm like, what a weird story that like someone told me when I was like 8 and now I can't forget it when I barely even knew what that was, what AIDS was, you know. And
I mean, it is a way for, I think, kids and teens particularly to sort of process something that they don't have the vocabulary to talk about in a real way. And this is instead like a, you know, through narrative or through kind of the imprint of stories they've been told for their whole lives so far. You can kind of get at something like that and try to, I don't know, like empower or forewarn like yourself and others.
Yeah.
There's also a certain like paternal fear to it, I feel like. We're going into Halloween season at this point, and I know I'm going to see a million stories about drugs hidden in candies and whatnot.
Oh my God. Yeah, I actually saw like an ecstasy, like, make sure your kids don't get ecstasy in their Halloween bag thing recently. And I was like, what? Who just gives away their ecstasy?
Who hands out ecstasy? Who gives away free ecstasy to kids? And what neighborhood do I go to?
I know, right?
Like everyone I know who has done ecstasy is like wants you to have a nice time and prepare you and like tell you what to do and stuff. Yeah. Not my bag. But
I feel like to plug one of my favorite podcasts, which is You're Wrong About. I don't know if you've listened to it. Sarah Marshall and Michael Hobbs, and they actually had a really good one about like the urban legends around like Halloween candy and like contamination, I think last year. And I remember them talking, they sort of talked about like the actual real life things that have happened that sort of prompted a lot of those stories, which were like super specific and like not in any way just like a random person putting, like just accidentally giving someone, like it's like there was like, I don't know, there was like one like actual, like a father was trying to kill his own son and put like something in a pixie stick. But like then that story somehow morphed into like a man gave out like
random
poisoned
strangers.
Pixie sticks. Yeah. Right. Yeah. And so it's like a really like individually very sad story.
Yeah.
But it's like, not the thing that we are all afraid of.
Yeah.
And it also, I feel like, really gets at this thing about, like, it's like what that child had to be afraid of were, like, his own father, not, like, strangers giving him poison. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And, like, so often that's the case where it's, like, we think that we're afraid of, like, a stranger doing a bad thing to us, when in fact it's far more likely for somebody who loves us and knows us to do something to us, to do something bad to us.
Yeah. So. I mean, that kind of random violence horror seems worse, but I think, again, it's like a little bit easier to, it almost like looks at the issue sideways a little bit to say like, well, it's just a random stranger for some random reason that you don't even know, you know, that could be the reason for that act, when in fact it's like a lot more tragic and seems more specific, but is in fact so much more common to look closer to home in that.
Right. I mean, it's the same. It's right. I mean, it's not to pound the point home, but like, I mean, that's the same thing about like sexual assault is right. Yeah. It's like far more like, it's more common if you just assaulted by somebody that like, you know, you're dating, you're on a date with, than like a stranger coming out of the bushes. Right. But we're more afraid of the latter because that's the one that sort of entered into this like mythological state, you know, of like, and like, here are some tips you can do to like prevent this like incredibly rare and I mean horrible but like super rare thing from happening, as opposed to like the incredibly common fact that like you could be assaulted by like a boyfriend or just some guy you met or whatever, you know. So it's just yeah
and I think about the ways that gun violence too might be kind of taken into this urban legend canon for kids growing up now.
Oh, that's interesting.
Growing up, we had the warnings of, you know, school shootings and a sort of like very reductive kind of like psychological profile of a person who would commit those acts.
Yep.
But now, unfortunately, like you say, movie theater, and that's the first thing that pops into my mind. Yeah, it feels like a thing that we are obviously going to be reckoning with. Hopefully one day will be an artifact of the past. But I feel like it is inevitable that somehow that's going to be kind of captured in the lore that, you know, middle schoolers are telling each other over chicken nuggets today.
Right. Mm. I'm just remembering being in middle school when Columbine happened. And I'm remembering like people were so panicked that like they let school out. Like, it was, like, such a bad situation, and it was so sort of unprecedented. And now it's, like, I feel like I don't know, like, I feel like we're kind of maybe a little off topic, but, like, yeah, it's just, like, this sense of, like, it felt so unthinkable at the time, and now it's just so, like, old hat, which is, like, not how I want to feel about anything that violent and horrible. The idea of, like, students or, like, young people developing, like, narratives and myths and urban legends around shootings is actually deeply chilling and really interesting to me.
Because I mean, myth as sort of self-protection is such a thing that I think about, not just in kind of urban legends and folklore, but also like, how do I tell the story of my life, and how does this like societal I don't know, like instruction that I think of myself as the protagonist and the hero of my own story, how does that impact my decision making? Because it doesn't just impact the way I tell my story to others and the way that I like shape and revise the past, but it also like inevitably impacts my future decision making. And I don't have like a thesis about that, but it's just like a thing that's in my brain all the time.
Yeah.
I do love the idea that we are like, we're always the hero of our own story, and to be the villain in someone else's story is something that's so typical for myth telling and myth building that I feel like, I don't know, there's I'm sure there's a lot to be said about that. I don't have the thoughts in my brain right now for it, but
well, one angle might be the sort of like hero villain dichotomy. Obviously a lot that you can kind of play in the middle there. There's a lot to sort of like queer that dichotomy. And I feel like that seems to me a sort of thing that you often kind of play or write in. Sort of like what, you know, what makes a hero, what makes a villain, like who is good, who is bad, who is able to do good and bad things. And to my mind, the answer is never like a hero is good, a villain is bad.
Yeah. I mean, I think I'm really interested. I mean, you know, with my first book, this was true, but also especially for this new book that I've written, like I've become very obsessed with this sort of dreaded gray area, which like I feel like some people are very much like, what is a gray area? There's no such thing. And I'm like, oh my goodness, there's such a space, and it's so wide and so misty. I'm really interested in so like an example that I give often is like I think about the story Cat Person, which I know like everybody in the world read, and I actually really love. And I think the reason I love it is because it gets at this really fundamental thing, which is sometimes you have sex with somebody because it's easier than saying no. And that often happens because you are a woman or a femme or female presenting person, and the person who you are going to have sex with is a man or mask or male or whatever. And it's just easier. And that's the dynamic. And that isn't assault. It isn't rape. But it isn't exactly consensual, you know. And it falls in this very weird place of like, and it's like, there's no, I don't think anyone goes to jail about that. But I do think that there's like a space to like honor and sort of recognize like the complexity of that idea. And I'm really interested you know, thinking about like Me Too and thinking about like, you know, obviously when you have sort of villains like, you know, Harvey Weinstein and Jeffrey Epstein and just these like sort of sinister or Matt Lauer or, you know, when you're saying things like, oh, he had like literally a, you know, sex island where he like trafficked young girls, or like he had a button on his desk that he could use to lock the door. Like, it's like, well, that's just like some straight like, out of like Bond. Villainy. It's such villainy. Like, it's almost comical. I mean, it's not comical. It's terrible. But it's like so on the nose. And it's like, if you, it's like how I feel about Trump. It's like, if you wrote it down, you'd be like, that's way too on the nose. Like, take that out. It's too comp. It's too like obvious. But I'm far more interested in things like, you know, it was ambiguous in some way or another. The person that abused me or fucked me over or like treated me like shit, you know, wasn't this sort of villainous figures, you know, the sort of mustache twirling, you know, Snidely Whiplash character. Like, there actually were, you know, it was somebody that I cared about, or like it was a woman, or it was, you know, not a person you would expect. Or the thing that was done to me was like nebulous. Like, it wasn't as clear cut as something like assault, because like, yeah, there are other things. And I feel like we really, as a society, like we crave these like neat edges and these like, did he rape you? Like, where, what did he put and where and when? And let's put that timeline together. And they're like, well, if it doesn't happen that way, then everything is okay. And it's,
I feel like,
well,
it's very influenced by like crime procedurals. And it, yeah, seems like, yeah, you have to point to like evidence, timeline, provable in court, like,
right,
knowable and irrefutable by like a jury of your peers.
Right. And it also assumes that like, A, that the law is in any way fair or just, which like we obviously know it's not, for all kinds of reasons.
Or that 12 random people could like pass judgment on you.
Totally. I mean, even before that, just like the, yeah, act, yeah, of police and the act of sort of, but like even besides that, like even if that process was completely impartial and fair, like there's a giant spectrum of behavior that falls outside of illegality, right? That is shitty and bad and fucked up and like not okay for people. And like, you know, I'm really interested in that. That's super interesting to me. And it's more interesting than the sort of like villainous, obviously villainous stuff, because the obviously villainous stuff, it doesn't come up very often, you know? And I think it's more important for us to like really begin to pull apart the more nuanced spaces. I just think it's just more interesting to me as an artist. And I think that's something that I try to write about in my first book. And it's also certainly something that I've covered in this new one, this memoir that's coming out.
You know, that's really interesting too, because I think that a lot of early mythology kind of reflects that gray area. Like, we talk a lot about how Zeus is the ultimate fuckboy, the fuckfather, if you will, on this show. And Zeus has done a lot of really terrible shit, but also he's the king of the gods and people worship him and give him, you know, sacrifices and all of that kind of stuff. And like, he's not always portrayed in a terrible light. So it's really interesting because you look at that and there's no black and white with the gods, because the gods are like human. The gods, yeah, have human personalities and, yeah, make mistakes and make faults and do fucked up things, but still like require a level of respect. And I think that's what I kind of love about early mythology in particular, is that there is no black and white. There is no, you know, Christian God and the devil. There's no good and evil necessarily. There's just like okay and pretty bad.
You know, it's so funny because I feel like I mean, I was sort of very religious when I was young, and I was very, very Christian, and I'm not anymore. But I think a lot about, you know, to me, the best parts of the Bible were like the parts where like Jesus gets super fucking mad. You know, he like turns some tables over. He like curses a fig tree. Like, he's just like, and I'm like, that is so much more interesting to me than like. And I feel like in Sunday school, they always like really draw this hard line. They'd be like, oh, it's righteous anger, like. Righteous anger is okay. It was like, but wouldn't it be great if Jesus just got fucking pissed because like he was a human being and that sort of part of being human or whatever. I don't know. I mean, I actually was always really interested in like, I mean, the Bible is such a weird book. There's like my favorite passage in the world, which I think it's 2 Kings. I can't remember the actual verse, but it's about a prophet who these youths tease him. They call him Old Baldhead. And they're saying, like,
love
they,
a good say, old insult.
Yeah, they're like, and they, I remember, like, the line from the Bible that I used to have was, go up, old bald head, go up, old bald head. And then he gets really mad and he summons a she-bear and she comes out of the woods and eats the youths.
Hell yeah.
And that's the whole fucking thing. That's great. And I always was like, that's metal as hell. That's like, way, that's like so, I love that.
That's some, like, pan bullshit and I'm here
yeah,
for
exactly.
It.
Right. It feels very, like, pagan, I think, is why I like it so much. It's just mm-hmm. so ridiculous. This idea that, like, yeah, like, most things exist in these spaces and that it's just simply more interesting, you know, and
or
more
in,
human.
In the Torah, like, Moses dies within sight of the promised land. Like, and does that make him not a servant of God? Like, you know, yeah. there is just such a palpable sense of, like, consequences that I feel like is... I don't know, so shocking, like, they went there. Like, that's how yeah. I feel all the time yeah. reading, like, the Torah and kind of other stories. Like, it's just, yeah. it's wild.
Yeah.
Amanda, this week, our episode is brought to you by Calm. And gosh, stress is a worldwide epidemic, isn't it? It's real bad. Like, we're all, like, even us who get to work our dream jobs, we're all working longer hours. The news cycle is exhausting. We're just like, stress is a part of our lives and I want it to go away.
That would be nice.
Thankfully, we have Calm. So Calm is the number one app to help you reduce your anxiety and stress and help you sleep better. So more than 40 million people around the world have downloaded Calm. It helps with guided meditations to help with your anxiety and your stress. I really like those. I like to do them, like, right when I get up in the morning because it starts my day off right. Like, I take my shower, I listen to a Calm thing, I take deep breaths. It's just easier that way. They also have the sleep stories, which I know you love. You're a big fan of the Southern France lavender fields of Stephen Fry. It's a big one.
That one's very good. And any train, Julie, just any train.
Just all the trains. There's also a new one about, like, moonlit jungles in Africa that I'm just, it's so pretty. I love it so much.
It's beautiful.
They also have just, like, soothing music and stuff. So anything that's going to, like, help you reduce your stress and anxiety, Calm is there to help you out. So right now, Spirits listeners can get 25% off a Calm premium subscription at calm.com/spirits. Again, that's calm.com/spirits. Get unlimited access to all of Calm's content today at calm.com/spirits.
Speaking of, like, meditative and stress relieving things, Julia, sometimes I go to Skillshare for, like, new skills I want to learn, but sometimes I go there just to watch the videos because the videos that they make are very high production quality, which I love. And also the ones about fine art and different kinds of crafts and hobbies that I might not necessarily have the skills to do, but I do want to know about them. I love watching it. So this week I was actually checking out a Skillshare class called Ink Drawing Techniques, Brush, Nib, and Pen Style by Yuko Shimizu. And it is so stunning to watch the just, like, paintings unfurl from her pen. Like, I know that sounds silly because it's just drawing, but as someone like me who doesn't have a ton of experience or skill in that arena, it's really wonderful not just to learn, but also to like watch and observe and be entertained by the kinds of classes you can see on Skillshare.
Yeah, I mean, that's why people love Bob Ross and stuff like that, or why calligraphy videos are so popular. And it's nice that Skillshare offers that as well as being able to teach you how to do the things and not just watching the person do the things.
Exactly. And today you can get 2 free months of Skillshare Premium, which gets you access to all of the 25,000 plus classes that they have to offer at Skillshare.com/spirits2. That's spirits and then the number 2.
Yep. Again, go to Skillshare.com/spirits2 to start your 2 free months now.
Skillshare.com/spirits2. Julia, I recently realized that I think I'm going to become, like, a museum gift shop old lady. You know
yes,
what I mean? Like,
correct.
One of those ladies who, like, only wears jewelry from museum gift shops and has just, like, statement glasses.
Just jotting down for your birthday in February real quick.
Thank you. I just want to, like, really prepare for that. And what I've done over the last couple of years is, like, each year when my eyeglass insurance lets me pay for a new pair of frames, I just grab one from Warby Parker. And it's really easy to keep my prescription updated. They let you, like, take a photograph of your prescription, which is wild and so much easier than having someone call someone else and having to follow up and fax and, like, blah, blah, blah. But moreover, their frames are so affordable. They're absolutely beautiful. And you can go ahead and try those on in your house. You don't have to, like, go find one of their retail stores or go in there and be sweaty and, like, try to wear makeup. But then, like, what if you don't have makeup on? And what do you look like in your house? It's so hard to tell.
Yeah, Jake actually did the free try-on program and he ended up taking home 2 pairs of glasses, one for his distance and one for his, like, desk reading. And they both look adorable on him.
Oh, that's great. It's just, it's super easy. You get to pick them out online. They come right to your house and you have 5 days to try on the 5 pairs of glasses that they send you. There's also no obligation to buy. It ships totally for free. It includes a prepaid return shipping label using the same box, which I like to cut down on that waste. And today, you can try your free home try-on kit at warbyparker.com/spirits.
Yeah, you can order your free home try-on kit today by going to warbyparker.com/spirits.
Glasses start at just $95, which includes prescription lenses. They also have anti-glare and anti-scratch coatings, and you can get those blue light filtering lenses, which Julia loves.
I love those. Those are my favorite.
And even better, if you have an iPhone 10 or above, you can actually do like a virtual try-on where Warby Parker like uses the camera and puts those glasses on your face, which is super cool. So that's warbyparker.com/spirits to get your free home try-on kit today.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
And now let's get back to the show. Well, I want to kind of broaden the idea of like source material. And we talked about urban legends, mm-hmm. but also like, Carmen, one of my favorite stories from you is based on Law and Order SVU. yeah. And I know that whether it's video games, TV, like it seems like a lot of things are in scope for you and for both of us as well. Like we talk all the time about how some of our favorite modern myths are podcasts, are video games, like are kind of places that we don't think of as like capital L literature. Mm-hmm. So can you talk a little bit about like your experience, you know, reading those, playing those, looking at them for inspiration? What are your kind of favorite examples?
Yeah, I mean, I think Law and Order SVU is interesting in particular because I think it's actually a really good example of like a modern, I don't know if I'd call it a modern fairy tale, but a fairy tale system of a kind. Especially because Law and Order and Law and Order SVU and the Law and Order franchise often hinge on this idea of quote unquote ripped from the headlines, or like a thing is sort of taken out of context and then kind of mashed together with a bunch, and then you watch this episode that like sort of vaguely resembles reality but not quite, but like so much so that like I remember during the election there was an, I don't know if you remember this, there was like an episode that was going to air that was about apparently about like a Trump-like figure, and NBC decided not to air it for reasons I don't remember.
I'm sure that had nothing to do at all.
Cough, but like yeah, like so they didn't air it. But it's so funny because it's like, well, it's fiction, so like, who cares? But it's like, obviously, it like was close enough that it hit some kind of note. So I sort of feel like, and it's been going on for so long, and it just has such a like a place in our culture and this sort of ubiquitousness that I think is sort of similar to the fairy tale as we more traditionally understand it. And so, yeah, it just feels like that's what it is. And so it was a real pleasure to get to like play with that. And I think, yeah, I mean, whenever I do anything, I read anything, I watch anything, I play any video games, like I'm always thinking about what is it in here that gives me like a kind of narrative pleasure, or I can sort of derive something from this idea. So like a really example I usually give is I really love this thing that happens in a lot of video games where you have to like, you know, clear out, you know, insert X here. It's like a thieves' den, or like a war, you know, it's like a collective of enemies which you have to like approach in a certain way and like clear out, and like you can get loot, right? And I always think it's really funny when I play games like that where when you approach it, you know, you're always like hearing their chatter, like they're always chattering at each other, and they're usually just these like kind of workaday, like, you know, like they're not like top brass, like they're all sort of like, you know,
they just live in their lives,
they're just living their lives. It's like they got a job as like a thief and a whatever, you know, that's just like they're like mercenaries. Yeah, exactly. And like I always am so tickled by their dialogue, which also if you stand there long enough will begin to repeat itself. And it's like waiting for Godot. It's like, and you are like, by virtue of your presence, just like hovering off on the edge, like listening to them talk, even though like it's mostly nonsense and like eventually or repeat itself. And like, I don't know. And also like some of the games, like if you make a noise or you move too quickly, they'll be like, what's that? And they'll be like, never mind. You're just hearing things, you know? So there's just something very like funny about that to me. And like when the more I play games, and it's like every third game I play, it comes up and I'm like, I need to do something with this. This is so interesting to me. I don't know what it is yet, like why it's so interesting, why it speaks to me in this way, but it's just like kind of beautiful.
That is very like Waiting for Godot though, because like I can imagine a fucking weird like 90-minute play where it's like the thieves in the pub or like all of the like NPCs in the tavern before a D&D campaign starts. And then what happens? Like, okay, maybe the dialogue repeats twice, but then if like inaction is also action in that way, and like if no one comes to interrupt that cycle, like what then happens? Do they organize? Like, do they fight each other? Like, what happens?
I mean, I'd watch that play.
I would too.
I'd write that play.
That'd be sick. Listen, if you write, just put me in the acknowledgements. Like, it's all good.
Yeah. I don't know. There's just something about that. And I just feel like that's like, and so I think to say, like, and I mean, it's funny because people are always surprised when I tell them I play video games. And I'm like, well, I mean, maybe you're surprised because I seem very busy. And I am, in fact, busy. And I do go through, like, lulls where I just, or where I haven't played games in a while because I've just been.
Oh, my first instinct was like, fuck you. Not all gamers are like teenage white men. Like,
oh, no. Well, that too. But I think people, so I think it's a combination of like, I don't fit the profile you would expect. And also they're like, you are hella busy. How do you have time to play games? It's like, well, there are times when I don't play them for months because I'm like really busy. But yeah. And the idea that I could enjoy like a game, you know, not even like a quirky indie narrative indie game, which is also a genre that I love, but also like I want to go shoot some stuff or like cut some stuff up with my, you know, sword or whatever. I want to kill some monsters and like, so I don't know. It's like, but there is something about the form of the video game and the way that like, you know, games, depending on their goals, fall into different sort of structural things and the way that games kind of adapt around. Like, I'm really also interested. So there are like two games that I've played, and I'm sure there are more that exist, but these are the two that I, there's The Last of Us, which is like a this zombie game, and then Witcher 3.
Yes.
And which I loved and was sort of one of the earlier games that I played in this like new patch of my life. And both of those games have a very mask, like male protagonist who is like either journeying with or interacting with like a young woman, right? Mm-hmm. Like there's a, like a, you know, a girl that they're sort of taking care of or they're sort of mentoring in a way. And in both of those games, there is a section of the game where it reverts the POV to the girl. So in The Last of Us, like at some point, I forget what happens to the guy, but like he's unconscious or he's sick and she has to like go get some stuff for him. And it's, and you're playing her. And then in the other game, it's like these periodic sort of like chapters where like instead of playing Geralt, you're playing like this, I can't remember her name, but this girl. And what's so interesting is like when you've been playing a certain character for many hours and you have like weapons and you have all this stuff and you have a certain amount of strength and like skills and whatever. And then suddenly they just like throw you into this like female POV that you haven't been experiencing the entire time. You have none of the shit that you're supposed to have.
New body.
You have a totally new body. And it's like really weird. And both times, the first time it happened, I was like, that's interesting. I was like, what is that? Huh. Like, is it meant to be that like I now feel like weak and helpless? Like, is that, because that's how I feel, because like I don't have any of my weapons. I don't have anything that I've gotten over this, you know. And then it's like, so is that intentional? And then like, what does that mean? And the second time it happened, I was like, you've got to be fucking kidding me. like, why is it? And it's so specific. It's like these like male, like it's just, it's such a weird, I don't even call it a trope, but like a weird thing.
Mechanic.
And it like, mechanic. Yes, that's the word. That's the word. It's like a weird mechanic. And it's like, what does it mean? And like, I keep thinking about it. And as I'm playing, I'm like, there's something happening here that's like outside of my, or that like, I don't know if they intended to do it or not, but I have like so many feelings about it. And I mean, this is true of like everything I consume. Like, I mean, when I, when we were about to have our wedding, I was like putting together centerpieces and I would like be in my pajamas, like hot gluing flowers to things. And my wife would like leave for work and be like, or my then fiance. And I'd be like watching Kitchen Nightmares and I'd be like, bye. And then she'd come back like 8 hours later and I'd still be doing the same thing in the same position, still watching Kitchen Nightmares. And after a couple of days, I was like, I have a theory about Gordon Ramsay. Like, I just was like, because I had just seen so many of them and I had so many thoughts. Well, I mean, for me, if you want to hear.
I want to hear your Gordon Ramsay theme.
There's very few things I love more than food, TV, and like criticism thereof.
Oh, okay. Well, I actually, first of all, I really like Gordon Ramsay. Like, I actually have a deep, abiding respect for competence.
Yes.
Like, that is a thing that gives me a lot of pleasure. And so I, like, really respect. Like, I'm like, he's an asshole, but.
That's how I feel about Top Chef. I'm like, I know that there is so much invented drama here, and the chefs are, like, increasingly, like, professional TV chefs, and that's kind of, like, a weird thing that's happening. But also, they are, like, relentlessly competent in what they're doing, and it's so relaxing. And, like,
totally.
Padma is always perfectly dressed, and it's just, like, it's, like,
I love
just
her so much.
Like,
Well, it's kind of like
me in this.
Right. It's like they're just like a really good top. Like you're like, yeah, like you know what you're doing. I relinquish everything to you. Like you know what's up, you know you're in charge. Like it's sort of beautiful in that way, right? But the thing about Gordon Ramsay in particular that was really interesting about Kitchen Nightmares was like that entire show was about negotiation of masculinity. So like the episodes almost always, I mean, there were women occasionally, but mostly the women were like the beleaguered wives or sisters or girlfriends or who or daughters or whoever. It was like about like the sort of alpha male, like Gordon had to like kind of knock down this sort of weird masculine alpha energy till it was like underneath him.
Yeah.
Or like, he had to like build them up.
Yeah.
Cause like there was some, I remember this one guy where they literally had him box in the middle of the episode. I don't know if you remember that episode. It was ridiculous. It was like so on the nose. And it was like,
that's some Karamo shit.
He was just this like sad sack guy who just like looked really sad. And he was like, we're going to go do some boxing. And they like box. And the man's like, I never knew my father. Like, it's just so like on the nose. And I was like laughing so hard cause it was so ridiculous.
But it's not 100% humorous. Cause like that person needed that.
No, totally. Yeah. Totally. Like, right. Like, obviously like it's not funny, but it's sort of funny because it's like
it's both
it's like
funny because it's needed.
Yeah, but also or like just watching and it's like really it's about him or like the men who like think that they're in and they're like I'm in charge, it's my restaurant, but they know like literally nothing. And Gordon Ramsay's like, well, that's fine, but like you know literally nothing and I know everything. So how are we gonna negotiate that? So I just feel like the whole show is just about this like gendered back and forth. And I think this is true also, like, I also watch Bar Rescue. And Bar Rescue's sort of the same way.
It's really good, though. Belagered woman bartender who's been, like, holding shit down for 3 years.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, this is what I mean. It's like, when I watch enough of these things, like, Val came home and I was just like, I have a theory about Gordon Ramsay. And, like, I feel like that to me is, like, when I'm consuming art and when I'm, like, doing stuff, even if it's not something particularly, like, quote, if it's, I don't like phrases like high and low art, but, like, something that's not particularly, like, artistic or literary, quote unquote.
Yeah.
I think there's still a lot to be derived from it in terms of like pleasure, like, and what makes it interesting, what advances it forward, what makes it pleasurable to watch, or not pleasurable, I guess.
Yeah, I have that feeling very often. Like my partner likes to point out that I really enjoy media with no conflict in it. Like that's I really true. Enjoy shows with no conflict.
Do you watch all the British? Do you watch like...
I super do.
Escape to the Country.
I watch Escape to the Country. It is my favorite program.
Val and I also watch Escape to the Country.
I like Extreme Homes Australia edition because it's even more extreme than other ones because in Australia, land is just forever.
Right, right.
Because that is how... the like land acquisition happened to that continent. And it's just, yeah, like, and in video games, I love Pokemon Go because I can just like walk around and not play any gyms and just like collect my pokes and like grow them. And that there's something I discovered a few years ago called a Nuzlocke run, which is, I believe, named after the gamer who invented it. But it's like a way to play the Pokemon Game Boy games with like a series of really interesting rules. So like in gaming and like speed runs and streaming, people put these really fascinating constrictions on ways to play the game. So like, can you play Super Mario without ever using the A button, you know, or like different ways. It is such a world.
Yeah.
Like look up Summer Games Done Quick, which editor Eric of Spirits showed me several years ago. And it's like a charity fundraising thing that happens every year. And gamers, like the best in class, people who like set world records in like these different genres of playing these games, do it live. And it is so wholesome and they raise money for like amazing charities. And it's just like, it's the best of that world.
Oh my God.
But the Nuzlocke run involves several different rules, one of which is you can't use any like potions or items to like heal your Pokemon. And if your Pokemon dies, you have to release it. Like if it faints, you have to release it. And as soon as I heard that, I was like, oh God, I have been treating these animals as a like endlessly renewable resource. And in fact, they're not. Like there is so much about that system that like it just didn't occur to me to question because it's in a video game. But I feel like my instinct to kind of question these structures in the world is heightened and sharpened by my ability to like look at video games, stories, TV shows, movies and be like, is it feminist or not? Like, was that a choice? You know, as a creator, I want to kind of always, I wish I could turn off that brain sometimes, which is why I really love Escape to the Country. But in playing Pokemon, I'm like, I like this makes it different and I make such different choices if I know that I cannot ever let my team faint.
Wait, can I tell you how I overthink Pokemon Go, which I also love?
Please.
Which is instead of I'm like to transfer them away. I actually hate that because I'm like, where are they going?
I know.
Like, where are they going?
Are they playing in the PC? Like, do they have like food?
See, to me, it feels like euphemistic. Like, it's like they're going to the upstate.
You know?
And I'm like, no.
and going to the ocean.
But like, you know, unless you want to keep paying to up your like Pokedex or whatever, like you have to, you know, I always am like very kind of weirded out by that. Like, where are they going?
Yeah.
What's happening to them? I'm actually, because they have this now, this like Team Rocket, and then they have these like possessed, or what are they, the dark Pokemon, but they're possessed basically. And I'm like very upset about it. I'm like,
that's not their fault.
That's not their fault. That's exactly what I think every time. I'm like, it's not their fault. Like, they're just, you know, they're just Pokemon. They're just little monsters. They're just living their lives. I don't know.
Rescue them. They're victims.
I think maybe like that's what makes like a writer, an artist, a creative type is like vastly overthinking everything, like narratively. Which is something that my family always used to tease me about, like overthinking stuff. But I think that's just like the way that my brain works. And
no, I'm just thinking, man.
It is hard. And also like, yeah, sometimes I wish I could turn it off. Though I agree that these like conflict-free, like escape to the country is really pleasurable because it's just like nobody's like, at the end they're like, have you chosen a house? They're like, not yet. And they're like, great.
I know.
At the end of the episode. And there's none of that like artificial, like he likes tiles, she likes carpet. Like, like well, how will they, you know, it's none of that like bullshit. It's just like, you know, sort of lovely, like people having like a lovely little trips and like, you know, looking at some cool houses and
or even Chopped, where like we know exactly what's going to happen. Every segment's going to be the same length. Like Ted is going to be there in another fabulous tie. And at the end of it, like no one's career has been validated or not. Like no one's self-worth has been judged. It's just like, did I do okay with these ingredients in this competition today?
Right.
And it's just like, it's so cut and dry in a way that it does register to me as like a plot-free TV because it's just like a discrete example of like competence or not. And
I love TV.
I love TV too. I know. I wish I could like go home and read novels all day long, but sometimes you need to like watch.
I mean, I
do,
and I think that like I have to be careful because sometimes I think because watching TV is easier because I do feel like when I watch TV, I feel like when I'm reading a novel, there's some like language part of my brain that's being activated that like makes me sort of a little more frenetic. Like there's some a more sense of activation. And I think when I'm really tired, it's like, I can't read. I just need to watch TV and I have to be careful. I mean, I'm just tired a lot, which is like part of the problem. But
I don't know. I feel like a thing we come back to again and again on the show is like being aware of and critical of the stories around you and like not just kind of accepting narratives that are given to you or the role that like life or people around you tell you that you have, but knowing that like every narrative is constructed and you always have the option to change it, to opt out of it, to rewrite it.
Yeah, I love that.
Well, Carmen, thank you for coming in and talking with us about all my favorite subjects.
Oh, my God. Of course. My pleasure. Anytime.
And please let folks know where they can find you and your work in bookstores and online.
So my website is carmenmariamachado.com. My Twitter and my Instagram are at Carmen M. Machado. My book, my memoir in the dream house is out now.
There you go.
And I am doing events in Brooklyn. I'm doing it, but I don't actually know. I don't remember when.
So folks can check out your website for your tour schedule and for links to get the book.
Absolutely.
Beautiful. Well, thank you again. And listeners, remember,
stay creepy.
Stay cool. Thanks again to our sponsors at calm.com/spirits. You can get 25% off a Calm premium subscription. At skillshare.com/spirits2, spirits and then the number 2, you can get 2 free months of Skillshare premium. And at Warby Parker, get a free home try-on kit at warbyparker.com/spirits. Spirits was created by Amanda McLaughlin, Julia Schaffini, and Eric Schneider, with music by Kevin MacLeod and visual design by Allison Wakeman.
Keep up with all things creepy and cool by following us at Spirits Podcast on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and Tumblr. We also have all of our episode transcripts, guest appearances, and merch on our website, as well as a form to send us your urban legends at spiritspodcast.com.
Join our member community on Patreon, patreon.com/spiritspodcast, for all kinds of behind-the-scenes stuff. Just $1 gets you access to audio extras with so much more available too. Recipe cards, director's commentaries, exclusive merch, and real physical gifts.
We are a founding member of Multitude, a collective of independent audio professionals. If you like Spirits, you will love the other shows that live on our website at multitude.productions.
And above all else, if you liked what you heard today, please share us with your friends. That is the very best way to help us keep on growing.
Thank you so much for listening. Till next time.